The only thing necessary for evil to prevail is that good men and women do nothing. I am simply a mouthpiece for good men and women around the world who want to make a difference. The engagement and the involvement of ordinary people is what is going to change our criminal justice system. Many have tried and failed, but the only difference between them and me is I'm bringing an army with me. This is Truth and Justice. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your Friday follow-up episode for episode 315, The Truth Will Set You Free. Now, you all know that in this week's episode, we had an incredible interview with Shauna Couples, Troy Eldridge's 1991 girlfriend, where she revealed to all of us that Troy Eldridge directly told her that he, in fact, did lie to send his brother away for life, a fact that he has led Shauna to believe for all these years was her fault.
Yeah, 315 was a milestone episode that goes to show what Truth and Justice is all about. Crowdsourcing, sharing information, discussing theories, teamwork, it's all working. Now, thanks to the efforts of the Truth and Justice Army, you were able to get this incredible interview that could very well be key in the effort to get Jesse Eldridge exonerated. I've been reading all the social media responses we've been getting and want to cover everyone's questions by taking a closer look at this interview and discussing what this could mean for Jesse's case.
That sounds great, and before we move on, we probably should address the fact that your voice may sound a little bit different this week than normal, and that's because Mike has started his Smile Direct Club aligner treatment.
Yep, I've got my invisible aligners in. It's going to be a four-month process. And
Still getting used to it.
Yeah, still getting used to it. I'm talking with a bit of a lisp. Hopefully within a couple of days that clears up, but if I do sound a little odd in this episode, it's because I have those in, trying to straighten a few things out.
All right, well, that sounds great. And in the second segment today, after the ad break, again, much like last week, we have another interview for you that is not directly related to the case. This week, we're going to hear from Jim Clemente. Now, Jim Clemente and I were on the phone talking about this case, and that's going to be your Sunday episode, which we'll talk a little bit more about at the end of the show today. But Jim is also launching a brand new podcast today, the day this is airing, June 9th, which is also, of course, the first day of CrimeCon in Indianapolis. So the interview you're going to hear today, and what was it, about 10 minutes, 12 minutes?
It was 14 minutes.
14-minute interview with Jim Clemente today is talking about his new podcast, where he'll be joined by co-host Francie Hakes. The podcast is called Best Case, Worst Case. And so, much like last week, if you don't want to hear anything other than case details after the ad break today, you can go ahead and shut it down. And hopefully, again, you'll all listen, much like you did last week with Shane Yoder, because this podcast sounds really cool. And this isn't a paid advertisement. You know, Jim is a friend, and he's been a huge supporter of our show. And I'm a big supporter of the work that he's doing. And so, I invited him to come on and talk to us about his new project. So, that'll be after the ad break. And one last piece of housekeeping before we get started, Mike. Today is the day that CrimeCon is beginning, June 9th. So by the time you're listening to this, as it turns out, Mike and I will be on our way to CrimeCon. We were able to work out the schedule by making some changes to this Sunday's episode so we could both be at CrimeCon all day and evening today, Friday, and for the first half of the day tomorrow, Saturday. And a lot of people have asked if we could do a meetup while we are in Indianapolis. And so I just want to take this moment to address that. And the answer is maybe. Keep your eyes out on social media. If you're not a follower of @TruthJusticePod on Twitter, take 10 seconds, make yourself a Twitter account, and follow us if you're in Indianapolis and you're interested. If we have time, I'm thinking, because my wife is coming with me and my girlfriend's going with him. And so we're thinking that we may, sometime around maybe 9:30 in the evening, meet down at the bar of the Marriott where CrimeCon is happening and do kind of an informal fan meetup. But just watch social media for that if we're going to be able to do that, which we probably should be able to, I think.
I would think so.
Yeah, as long as we have nothing else important going on, we're going to try to do kind of a fan meetup in Indianapolis at the JW Marriott, which is right downtown. And other than that, Mike, I'm ready for you to take it away.
Okay, let's get started. At this point, it looks like Shauna should have been called at trial to testify for Jesse. Since, as we found out in your interview, she says she can refute Troy's claims of Jesse being involved in the crime. But just to straighten this out, she says she wasn't actually with Jesse on the morning of the murder, right? I thought I remember saying she saw him get into a car and leave the apartments that morning.
Yeah, well, she said that she saw him get into a car and leave that morning, but it was later that morning. I mean, remember, this happened at 7:30 in the morning.
Okay.
So based on her recollection, she slept in. She wasn't up at 7:30 in the morning. Her and Troy both slept in. Him and Jesse didn't go anywhere together. Troy gets out of bed, goes out into the living room. Him and Jesse are in the living room talking. She then gets out of bed, meets Troy and Jesse in the living room talking. They all chat, I think she said, for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. Everything was normal. Nobody was sweaty. Nobody was bloody. Nobody was acting strange. And then Jesse ended up leaving for the day and going somewhere. So she was kind of with Jesse that morning, from the best of her recollection. But it was just in the living room briefly before he left for the morning. But all of this is, you know, hours after Kiao's murder would have occurred. You know, okay. She didn't wake, you know, they were out late that night before. And so she wasn't up at 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, it was my guess is she didn't really say a time, but, you know, 8, 9, 10 o'clock later in the morning.
Okay. So then if Shauna actually gave a statement to Detective Watts, we have to assume that the statement ended up in the hands of the prosecution. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, we know it did because okay. We got that in our open records request from the prosecution. As a side note, I filed a records request with Dallas DA's office and with Dallas PD, all of these back in January. The DA's office was pretty quick to get me back my request, although I'm pretty sure I don't have everything that I'm supposed to have. Nothing from the police department until 2 days ago, where I see that they have now filed an exception with the, or an appeal with the attorney general's office saying they don't want to fulfill my request, which is going to be another Smith County type drag out, knockdown fight with me, as far as I'm concerned, because the law says, and I'm not a lawyer, but it says that they have 10 days to appeal giving me the documents of the AG's office.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't do that, then they just have to turn it over. I don't think they can wait 5 months and then decide that they're going to file an appeal with the attorney general. But anyway, we'll see what comes of that. But in any case, getting back to your actual question, yes, her statement to Detective Watts was in the prosecution's file because that's where I got it. So we don't know if that was turned over to the defense. So we don't know if Jesse's attorney saw it or not. But what we do know is that the prosecution did, in fact, have that statement.
Okay, and taking this a step further, let's assume that the prosecution played by the rules and turned that statement over to Jesse's defense team. If this is what happened, why might you think they didn't call Shauna to the stand at trial? And along those lines, how is this grounds for an ineffective assistance of counsel claim?
Shauna is effectively Asia McClain from the Adnan Syed case. And so that's a really good picture for most of us who aren't, you know, really knowledgeable in the law. We're not lawyers, you know, you, not even me, or a lot of the listeners. But we learned a lot through, not necessarily Serial, but more through Undisclosed in Season 1 of Truth and Justice, and how things worked with Adnan Syed's case. So what we saw in that case was that Adnan's attorney, Christina Gutierrez, had information indicating that Asia McClain could have been a valid witness. They're actually required by what's known as the Strickland standard, which is where the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is based from, to at least contact that witness and speak to them. So how it relates here is with Shauna, the prosecution, assuming they play by the rules, handed over their documents to the defense. Now, this would be an exculpatory document. I mean, they have one piece of evidence, one, and that's Troy Elder saying he was out jogging with Jesse that morning and witnessed the attack happen. And they have a statement from his girlfriend, who lived by all accounts with both of them, saying that Troy didn't go anywhere with Jesse that morning. So the fact that the defense didn't call Shauna, right there, that's enough for an ineffective assistance to counsel claim, because she also said that she saw in that statement, she said that she saw Jesse in the apartment that morning. So she effectively becomes his alibi, or one of his alibis. And besides that, this case is based entirely on the credibility of Troy Eldridge. So to not call a witness to the stand that can directly impeach the credibility of the one and only witness is just an extremely gross example of ineffective assistance of counsel.
If the prosecution never turned Shauna's statement over to Jesse's defense team, this would be considered a Brady violation, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it really is a double-edged sword. There's really just no way out of this for the state. And understand, when I say there's no way out of it for the state, we're not dealing with Thiru and Vignaraja here.
Uh-huh.
You know, where you have a prosecution that 20 years later is fervently fighting against this. Jesse's case is in the hands of the Conviction Integrity Unit. And the CIU is actually working with Allison of the Innocence Project of Texas, trying to determine if this was a fair trial. And if not, they want to correct it. So
everybody's on the same team. So the process of getting him out, if that were a possibility, would be tenfold easier.
Right. Yeah. So I just wanted to clarify that when I say that, you know, it's a double-edged sword for the state. That's not like the state is fighting against this, but just for, let's say, the prosecution just in general, if we're just drawing sides, the defense and the prosecution, for the prosecution, this is problematic. Because Allison can make a claim here and say, this is ineffective assistance of counsel because Jesse's attorneys had access to the statement and they never even bothered to contact Shauna. Now, that was the big thing. For those of you that didn't catch the hugely important significance of what Shauna said in this week's episode, the fact that she was never contacted by the defense is what really drives us home to be ineffective assistance of counsel. Because had she been contacted, then Jesse's attorneys could claim that they didn't call Shauna for strategic reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But it was proven in the Strickland case, the Strickland standard, that you can't do that. You can't make a strategic decision if you never even make contact to find out what the person is going to say. So all they had was in black and white that she's conflicting the story. She's impeaching Troy. So they can't say there was a strategic reason to not call her because maybe they thought she was going to say this or thought she was going to say that without ever contacting her. So that was huge for ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, the only way that I think that the state could counteract that if they were trying to fight against this would be to say, well, they never had that document. So it's not ineffective assistance of counsel because they didn't know that document existed. And if that's the case, then we fall onto what you just said. Now it's a Brady violation. This is a clearly material and exculpatory document that was required by law, by the Brady versus Maryland standard, to be turned over to the defense. So if the defense didn't have it because the prosecution didn't give it to them, then this becomes now a Brady violation, which would also mean a new trial. So Shauna makes for a really massive case that Jesse Eldridge didn't get a fair trial, aside from the fact that his due process rights were violated by his own brother giving false testimony against him to convict him and everything else we know about, and hopefully some DNA evidence and everything going forward. But Shauna in and of herself could be, and I'll say should be, enough to grant Jesse a new trial. He clearly did not get a fair trial based solely on what Shauna said.
Sure. We also heard in the interview that Shauna was on the prosecution's witness list, but some listeners suspect that she may have been tricked into being kept out of the courtroom. Could this have been the sixth strategy by the prosecution to win their case, or is that a little too tinfoil hatty?
No, I don't think it's tinfoil hatty at all. And as you know, like, I brought that up on the show because that's exactly what I think happened. Why would the prosecution put her on the witness list? So let's put ourselves in the mind of the prosecutor. You have a weak sauce case, right? You have no physical evidence, no witnesses. You have one witness, actually, and Troy Eldridge. That's the entirety of your case. So Troy Eldridge tells his story, and then you go through the police file that the police have turned over to you, and you go through it and you see, well, here's Troy Eldridge's girlfriend. She was interviewed by Watts. Oh, shit. Her statement conflicts with Troy's. This is a problem. Now, you could have went and talked to her, send a prosecutor's investigator, or just call her into the prosecutor's office and have a conversation with her and find out, well, what really happened, and you know, you try to get a feel. Now, to do this all above board, you're not trying to put any ideas in her head, but just to try and figure out what she's going to say.
Right.
You know, feel her out a little bit to decide if you want to put her on the witness list or not. The fact that Blackman never contacted her, she had no contact from the prosecution. She just got a subpoena telling her that she needed to be there to be a witness. So I think it was certainly strategic. I mean, the prosecutor is not doing anything by accident. And so I think that by him putting her on the witness list, he was doing that just strictly, well, I think maybe for two reasons, actually. One, to keep her out of the courtroom, because Troy probably told Blackman, she's not going to go along with this. There's no way. Like, you just need to leave her out of it. So they kept her out of the courtroom. But then the other thing that it accomplishes is, it is kind of a bluff to the defense. So now imagine yourself on the other side. You're Jesse's defense, right? You're preparing for trial. You have no idea what you're preparing for. All you know is that there is one witness that says you did it. There's no other evidence that's been presented to you. And then you look on the witness list, and there's Shauna Couples on the witness list. So they could do that maybe as a deterrent, I guess, so that the defense would think, oh, Shauna must be on their side. And now, granted, that does not negate the Strickland standard for ineffective assistance of counsel. You can't say, well, I didn't call her because the prosecution put them on their list and I assumed she was going to say something that helped them.
Right.
But that could have been, I don't know, maybe a strategy, but I think definitely it was intentional to keep her out of that courtroom. You know, they never clearly intended to call her as a witness any more than Thiru Vignaraja intended to call Rabia Chowdhury as a witness at Anand Syed's PCR hearing. It was strictly done to keep her out of the courtroom.
Okay, so when discussing why Shauna was never called at trial on the fan page, one of our listeners, Tammy, writes to us, "My very limited understanding of the law is that the prosecutors can get away with not disclosing a witness statement if they don't call them as a witness. Could this be another reason the state didn't call her, so they wouldn't be required to turn over her statement to the defense?"
No, absolutely not. The Brady standard, which comes from the case Brady versus Maryland, is crystal clear. The prosecution is required to turn over any and all material exculpatory evidence to the defense, period. No exceptions, no way out of it, no ifs, ands, or buts. Everything has to be turned over. So think about it. If that were the case, the prosecution could have a whole pile of evidence. Say they tested DNA or found an eyewitness that said, no, I saw that person do it.
Right.
But you're trying to convict somebody else. That would be saying that they could say, well, I'm just not going to call him as a witness. That way I don't have to disclose that he pointed who the real killer was. That's not the case at all. I mean, it's a good thought, and I always like people really digging into the details and trying to kind of process through what some options were. But no, there is no way out of Brady at all. Any evidence that the prosecution has must be turned over to the defense, period, whether they use it or not.
Sure.
And usually they're not going to use it. If you think about it, if it's material and exculpatory, the prosecution's not going to use it because it's going to hurt their case by definition.
I think we were all blown away to hear Shauna say in the interview that Troy admitted to her that he lied to lock up his brother for her. Listener April wants to know, can anything be done in regards to someone admitting that they lied on the stand? Troy told Shauna that he lied for her. Or is all of this too late? And I think she's referring to a statute of limitations on perjury here.
Yeah, there is the statute of limitations on perjury is gone. Troy is not at risk at this point of being convicted of perjury. However, this could play out in a lot of different ways. The way I would love to see this played out is that we get a PCR hearing with witnesses like Anand Syed had, and for Troy Eldridge to be called to the stand. So, if, say, Allison makes a claim, and I don't know that she's planning on doing this, but so I'm not speaking for her. I'm just saying if she made a claim of a due process violation because Jesse was convicted based on false testimony, which is a thing if you can prove it.
Right.
That's what happened with Carrie Max Cook's case with James Mayfield recanting his statement. Well, then that became a due process violation. The conviction's thrown out. So anyway, I would love to see a hearing to put Troy on the stand, because this is the thing. What Shauna said to me, people have asked me, and you may get into this later, but can what she said be used in court? And yes. However, we've talked a little bit before about hearsay, right? So based on my understanding of the law, you can't just have Shauna get on the stand and say, Troy Eldridge told me this, because that's hearsay. But one of the hearsay exclusions or exceptions is for impeachment testimony. So I don't know if you can use that against what he said at trial.
Okay.
But what I do know is if you brought Troy onto the stand and asked him, did you ever tell Shauna Couples that you lied for her and sent your brother away to prison for her?
Right.
Now, if he says no, that opens the door then to put Shauna on the stand and ask her the same question. Because at that point, you can balance the two with each other. So he says no. And then she can come up and say, and we ask her, did Troy ever tell you that? And she says, yes, he told me that.
Now, really quick, you're talking in the context of a retrial, not a PCR hearing, right?
Could go either way, because it depends. Now, in Texas, there's not a lot of times a PCR hearing like a non-had. Like, a lot of times, whatever happens with Jesse, he may never, or Ed, may never be brought from prison back to a courtroom somewhere. A lot of times, this is just all handled through paperwork and briefs back and forth. Anand was actually given an actual hearing where we called witnesses for 5 days in his. So it was like a trial.
Mm-hmm.
This could go either way. So if there was an actual hearing, and this is just like my fantasy world, right? Like, I would love to see Troy get confronted on the stand with the things that he told Shauna. But for me, just kind of getting into the legal requirements of it, like, how does hearsay come in was the question that some listeners had asked me, like, could her statement be used? And that's how. If Troy was put on the stand under oath and claimed he didn't say it, then Shauna could come up and say that he did. And if it was a retrial, then there would be for a jury to hear that and to decide who to believe.
Sure. And if they were to do that now, would that reopen the statute of limitations?
On the perjury?
On the perjury.
Well, it wouldn't necessarily reopen the statute of limitations on the perjury, but what it would become is a new perjury charge. So the original perjury charge would be the fact that Troy lied under oath in 1996 at Jesse's trial. that statute of limitations is long since been over with. Now, if there was a PCR hearing and he were to swear in under oath again and be proved to be lying again this time, now it's not that it reopened the statute from back then, but it's a new charge. He could be hit with perjury again now. So if he were to lie under oath now, and then we can prove he's lying right after that, you know, say through DNA evidence. Say Troy gets on the stand and says, yes, again, still, I watched my brother attack that woman. And he gets off the stand, and right after that, the forensic examiner comes up and says, here's the DNA evidence, we know who did it. And then right after that, the person who they actually caught, whatever, afterwards, you know, somebody can confess, just as an example, like somebody confessed. Like, sure. This person confessed to killing her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now we know for a fact that Troy lied. And then Troy could be charged with perjury. And I hope to God if that happens, somebody does it because he deserves it.
Yeah.
And aggravated perjury in Texas, from my understanding, aggravated perjury, which this would be aggravated because it put Jesse away for 20-some years, could hold a sentence of up to life.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't that be something?
Yeah, Troy Eldridge gets put away for life for lying to put his brother away for life.
All right. And at the end of the episode, you mentioned that the Shauna interview had been turned over to Allison Clayton. With it in her hands and with the help of the Dallas Conviction Integrity Unit, what can be done with this interview to help Jesse, and what do you want to see happen with it?
Well, what it does is it opens a door. And so, like I'd mentioned, I think 2 weeks ago, you know, there are some witnesses, Troy, for example, that, you know, I'm done with it, that's a CIU thing. You know, they've got their own investigators, and he was a witness at trial. They're doing their own investigation, and the last thing that I want to do is get in the middle of that or get in the way of it. Shauna was a different story because Shauna, as far as any of us knew, had nothing to do with this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she wasn't at the trial. She didn't testify. So when she reached out to me and said, hey, I want to talk, that's fine. I didn't even let the CIU know that that was going on because she had nothing to do with it. What happened was during the course of that conversation, it became apparent that she does matter. None of us knew that, understand before that. None of us knew that Shauna had information that could prove Jesse did not receive a fair trial. And now we do. So now it's been turned over to the chain of command, so to speak, here is I give it to Allison, and then Allison goes to the CIU. I mean, I had the conversation, but from this point, you know, moving forward, that's the flow of information. So Allison has it. She will be, if she hasn't already gotten a hold of the CIU, let them know about it. And so what it does is it opens the door to where either Allison or somebody from the CIU will meet with Shauna and work out putting together affidavits. They'll interview her in a more formal setting. They may even depose her, you know, go through a deposition where she's under oath, things like that. And so they're starting to build the case for the fact that Jesse didn't receive a fair trial. So it's not like they're going to take this interview that I had with her over beers and use that as the evidence at trial.
Right. Okay.
It's just the door opening to say, whoa, hey, I know you were looking over here at Troy and we're looking at forensic evidence and Brady violations, but hey, we got something over here too that needs to be looked into. And it's just building. Jesse's case is so, his case was so insane that his claim of actual innocence is not going to be, hey, we're claiming actual innocence because of this thing. It's going to be, here's 20 reasons why Jesse's innocent, and so let's hear all of them.
Right.
And all it takes is for one of them to be approved by the DA and the judge for Jesse to at least get a new trial. And I think we all know how a new trial would work out. I mean, they've got nothing.
Yeah. All right. That's all we've got for social media today.
So now we're going to take our last break to hear from our sponsors. And then when we return, we'll have an interview with Jim Clemente and his co-host of his new podcast, Francie Hakes. Like we mentioned at the beginning of the show, this is a short interview where they're going to tell you about their new project. And if you're interested, after the closing credits, we're going to play a 3-minute trailer for their new podcast. So here come the ads, and then we'll hear from Jim Clemente, and then stick around to the end of the show to hear the trailer for Jim and Francie's new podcast. Now here's my conversation with Jim Clemente and Francie Hakes about their new podcast, Best Case, Worst Case. Okay, I am now on the phone with our good friend Jim Clemente and a woman by the name of Francie Hakes. Am I pronouncing that right, Francie?
It is. It's just like Francie Hakes bakes cakes.
Yes, she does, and they're good.
It's good. So that's why Jim and Francie are together. Francie is actually Jim's personal chef. She makes all of his cakes while he's investigating crimes in the studio. That's obviously not true at all. Francie is, and I don't know a whole lot about you, Francie, but you're a former prosecutor, is that right?
I am. I was a state and a federal prosecutor for just about 16 years, prosecuting lots of different kinds of cases, specializing in child abuse. I did a few national security cases and all sorts of other state and federal crimes.
Well, that's awesome. And everybody knows Jim's resume from being on the show several times.
Yeah. I always love coming on Truth and Justice and working with you, Bob. It's always been a pleasure.
We actually just got done doing just that. So for the listeners, our original plan for this follow-up was Jim and I were going to chat for a few minutes about Kiao's case and then talk a little bit about what we're going to talk about now, which is Jim and Francie's new podcast. But as Jim and I have learned over the years, that we can't talk for less than an hour about the weather, much less. So what's going to happen now is Sunday's episode is going to be the what turned into an hour-long interview with Jim Clemente on Kiao's case. But for today's episode, this is actually timed perfectly for this week's Friday follow-up because, Jim, are you and Francie actually launching your new podcast today while CrimeCon is starting?
That's correct. We're launching Best Case, Worst Case, our podcast that we're co-hosting from CrimeCon. We're going to do a live podcast there, and we're going to release three or four other episodes at the same time so people will get to come with us. We want to take listeners behind police lines. What Francie and I are doing with Best Case, Worst Case is through a series of interviews with our friends and colleagues, we're going to tell people about the most notorious and infamous cases from the mouths of the police and the prosecutors who actually lived the cases. And this is an opportunity for Francie and I to tell people what the breadth of experience is of law enforcement professionals, because some cases are incredibly exhilarating because justice works, because we're able to bring offenders to justice and provide justice for the victims of crimes. And most of the time with us, it's violent crimes. But other times the justice system can be broken, and whether the case is successful or not, it can have a profound effect on the professionals that work there. Right, Francie?
That's right, Jim. And in fact, Jim and I interviewed each other for each of our best cases and worst cases. And one of the things that we talked about that was so difficult, frankly, was coming up with a worst case, one worst case, because especially for someone like me, having worked so much child abuse, and for someone like Jim doing profiling crimes against women, crimes against children, it's very difficult to single out a worst case. So many of them are so grim, and some, as Jim well knows, are gruesome. And so that, I think, was one of the most difficult things. And I think it was also hard for our friends and colleagues. We've already interviewed quite a few. I think our listeners are really going to enjoy hearing that insider perspective, that step-by-step personal impact perspective from our friends and colleagues. But they experienced the same thing, Bob. They had trouble also deciding which out of many bad cases was their worst.
I'm sure. You know, and I was just, as you guys were explaining this, and Jim's talked to me a little bit about what the show is going to be before, and it sounds so intriguing because as he's telling me about it, I'm thinking about not law enforcement, but my 16 years in the fire service. I just immediately start thinking, like, what would be my worst case I went to? And it was exactly what you just said. I can think of, like, oh, that one was horrible. To me, it was for this reason, and this one was awful for this reason, and this one was the worst for this reason. So to try to narrow that down, I can't wait to listen and hear all these stories from people that were on the front lines.
Well, Bob, all the more reason why we should interview you repeatedly for our podcast, because you do have a lot of cases, and I'm sure some of them were pretty horrific. And we would like to invite you to come on so you can get an opportunity to talk to our listeners and your listeners about how the cases that you investigated affected you. And I'm sure that now that you're doing it full time as an investigator, you know, basically leading an army of investigators around the country and around the world, you are going to have more cases to discuss with us than probably anybody else.
I would love to get on and talk, you know, because that's something that, you know, my listeners, they know what I did for a living, but I've literally never talked about it. And I'm sure a lot of the people that you're interviewing, they're just not things, you don't really have that outlet to speak about these bad cases or even the good cases, because no one really has much of a perspective if they weren't there. It's just an incredible idea that you guys have, and I would love to participate.
One of the things we have in common, Bob, is well, at least for me, one arson case. And if you could see me in my office, you would see proudly displayed. I have an honorary fire chief helmet and an ATS, real ATS fire helmet from a serial arson case that I tried when I was a federal prosecutor. So maybe we can talk about that one of these days.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
That'd be great.
Yeah, I mean, for me, you know, my experiences range from investigating arsons, even just some of the accident reconstructions. But yeah, there's, I mean, enough about me. Let's talk about your show. But yeah, I guess the answer to your question, Jim, yeah, I'm in. Just say when, and I'd be happy to do that.
Great.
So you guys are setting this up, if I'm understanding right, so that the listeners can actually binge. You said you're going to release 4 or 5 episodes right off the bat?
Yeah, that's what we want to do. Our plan is to, you know, just so that we can get people interested in the show and also give them an opportunity to hear sort of a spectrum of the kinds of cases that we're going to do. The format that we have is we'll interview people about their best case, and that'll be an episode. We'll interview them about their worst case, and that'll be a different episode. And they won't necessarily be in order because we think it's more interesting to hear from different people over at different times. So I think that our listeners are going to be very intrigued. As Francie and I are, as we're interviewing our friends, sometimes we didn't even know. Knowing these people for a long time and being professional colleagues with them and friends, we didn't know some of the cases that they worked, and we certainly didn't know the dramatic effects it had on their lives and their career. So it's been really interesting learning that, and can't wait to talk to more and more of our friends and colleagues about their cases.
We've already had some absolutely incredible interviews from really experienced professionals in some very dramatic moments in some of the most notorious and infamous cases that listeners on both Bob, your podcast, and ours will certainly recognize. And I think the best thing for me about the podcast, this is my first podcast, is that I love talking about crime, and it's so just engaging and enlightening to talk to friends and colleagues about all of their interesting cases. And for Jim and I to get a chance to have that kind of discussion with our colleagues, I think and hope will be very interesting to people.
Yeah, it really will. Is there any chance, since this is going to air right before you guys drop all the episodes, we can get any kind of spoilers or teasers of the cases we might be hearing about?
For your listeners, we will. Because we are very, very loyal Truth and Justice listeners ourselves. So yeah, you're going to hear cases like Casey Anthony, who was the mother of Kaylee Anthony, who was pretty obviously murdered. And Casey Anthony was not convicted of that crime. She was acquitted of that crime. And there's a lot of information that the public doesn't know about that case. And we'll be talking to FBI agent Nick Savage. And yes, that is his real name, about his work on that case. We'll also be talking, as Francie said, to each other. Francie interviewed me about my best case and my worst case, and I interviewed Francie about hers. I think you're going to be hearing about a couple of very notorious cases from Francie and I, as well as from the other people that we interviewed. And I think one of the most revealing interviews that we have done so far was Jerry Williams, right, Francie?
It was, and her reaction to one of the earliest and first cases in her career, I think, is something that is really going to have a dramatic impact sort of emotionally on people who are listening to her talk about it, because she talks about it so nakedly, honestly, in a way that really makes people understand that these agents and cops and prosecutors are no more than human, and that humanity sometimes leads to mistakes. They learn from them. The public learns from them. Unfortunately, sometimes they learn from them in the public. But nonetheless, it really humanizes, I think, on a level listeners will really appreciate these investigators who dedicate their lives to catching bad guys.
And the thing is about that particular case, I mean, I really believe that it's been haunting her for her entire career and into her retirement for the wrong reasons. And I don't believe that her interpretation of what happened was accurate. I believe that she was blaming herself for something that had nothing to do with her. And in fact, I believe she saved lives by what she did in that case.
Wow, well, this all sounds incredibly intriguing. And so now, are they dropping today, which is the 9th, or when exactly will the first episode drop? On the 9th?
Yes. The first episodes will be dropping today, June 9th, 2017 at CrimeCon. Be there.
Well, that's great. I can't wait to meet you, Francie, at CrimeCon. And Jim, I'm always looking forward to meeting up with you again. And I think you're going to have Laura and Lisa with you at the event, aren't you?
Yes.
Excellent. It'd be good to catch up with all you guys and meet you, Francie. And for all of the Truth and Justice listeners, as soon as you're done, not until you're done, but as soon as you're done listening to this episode, go check out Best Case, Worst Case with Jim and Francie.
And you can get it on iTunes or Wondery.com or wherever you listen to your podcast, because Best Case, Worst Case is here, and we're going to take you behind police lines.
Awesome. And Jim has also given me a trailer that we will play right after this before our closing credits. And I'm going to let you guys go. But like I said, when the listeners are hearing this, we're just hours away from hanging out with each other. So we'll be seeing you guys this afternoon.
Thank you, Bob.
All right, great. And Bob, thank you so much for doing this. We really appreciate it. And honestly, it's just a really, really kind thing that you're doing. So thank you.
It's my pleasure. I mean, I think Truth and Justice and Real Crime Profile, well, before Real Crime Profile was a thing, just you working along with us since the very beginning of case number one, I think that we've always had a relationship where we work together and have helped build each other up. So I'm looking forward to continuing doing that. And it's my pleasure.
And Bob, right, cool. I'm Southern, so I have to offer to buy you a bourbon in Indianapolis.
I will absolutely take you up on that.
Excellent.
You could also make him a cake.
Right.
That'll be a little hard in the hotel, I think.
Well, you know.
Bourbon it is. Take care, guys.
Thanks, Bob. Appreciate it.
Yep. Bob.
Bye.
Take care.
All right. Bye.
Okay, well, that's all the time we have today. Thank you for taking the time to listen. Remember that if you happen to be in Indianapolis tonight, Friday the 9th, whether it be for CrimeCon or for any other reason, we're probably going to try to have a meetup this evening around 9:30-ish p.m. in the hotel bar of the downtown JW Marriott.
It's going to be a great time, and I look forward to seeing all of you there.
And I want to encourage everyone to make sure you download this Sunday's episode. When I got Jim Clementi on the phone to talk about his new podcast, we ended up talking about Jesse and Edward VIII's case for about an hour before we got to this. Jim asked a lot of questions about what we found since he did his original profile and has given us some updates. And since we had to get out of the office early this week in order to get down to CrimeCon, this week's episode is going to be that hour-long conversation with me and Jim Clementi. So check it out on Sunday. Truth and Justice is a production of New Beginning Incorporated. Our executive producer is Mike Bussing. All music for the show is created by PutThemInASong.com. I want to thank Amanda Meyer for creating the Friday follow-up logo. Thank you to Chris Brinkley of SylviaConsultants.com for creating and managing and maintaining our website. And thank you to our transcription team, Sarah Hoyt, Sarah Mueller, and Desiree Dunn. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you want to keep in touch with what's going on in Indianapolis this week, you should definitely sign up for Twitter and follow us at Truth Justice Pod. But however you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
And I'm Mike Bussing.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Best Case, Worst Case takes you behind police lines. Through a series of interviews of our colleagues and friends, you'll find out what happens behind the scenes of the most notorious cases and the infamous ones. Welcome to Best Case, Worst Case. This is your host, Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler, and co-host, Francie Hakes, former federal prosecutor.
And that was very difficult for her to testify. She was 10 years old. She had to go into the courtroom, swear to tell the truth, sit in the witness stand and stare at her father.
This is a horrible case. Horrible because an innocent man was killed by the police department who thought they were protecting the community.
And I remember thinking they have murdered an unarmed man.
Absolutely, and that's what I thought until I learned the facts.
As soon as I opened that trunk, I mean, the decomposition smell was, well, it was human decomp.
This tells me that there's a level of planning, but not great planning. Low criminal sophistication in this case.
Yeah, no, she was a great liar. I mean, she wasn't just a pathological liar. She was a great liar.
He's never getting out. I call that, as listeners may already know, I call that a pine box sentence because he's coming out of federal prison in a pine box.
And the kid immediately knew, like, this guy was trouble.
I don't think people who kill are thinking about repercussions.
The punishment is taking away their freedom. That's the punishment. The retribution side of it is not only infantile, it is just absurd when you're thinking about a state or a country having retribution against one of its citizens that has broken the law.
When an offender on death row waits 20 and 25 years to be executed, I don't know that has a deterrent effect
right. Well,
on anyone.
Your system can't work unless it takes 20 or 30 years. So
it talks about the duty of a public prosecutor, the profound and almost sacred duty of a public prosecutor is not to seek conviction, but to seek justice.
Subscribe today on Apple Podcasts or your favorite listening app so you don't miss a single episode. Best Case, Worst Case takes you behind police lines.